Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, a Bulwark contributor, a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I'm joined again by my colleague in all things strategy, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, about which more later. Elliot, how are you?
I'm okay, although I have to tell you, I got a sort of a nasty blow this morning, which I just wanted to mention to everybody. I think a lot of our listeners probably listen to a wonderful podcast called Ukraine the Latest that's put out by the Telegraph. It's been put out really every day, every weekday, that is, since the Russian full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's had really terrific coverage. They've interviewed all kinds of interesting people. They've done reporting on the ground. And alas, the guy who came up with the idea, David Knowles, who's a young journalist, only 32 years old, suddenly died. And it was a real shock to, I think, those of us who've been listening to it. I, as I'm sure you feel, often with a podcast that you listen to regularly, you almost feel that you know these guys. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the show a couple of times. They had a live event at the British Embassy, and I've been on a couple of times. And so it's a real loss. I mean, it's been a brilliant piece of journalism. I think it will carry on. Their military correspondent, Dom Nichols, and Francis Dernley, the assistant comments editor, made that very clear. They both spoke in a sort of abbreviated version of the podcast today, and you could tell they were just both shattered. So a tribute to somebody who's, you know, really, I think, contributed to the cause of Ukraine simply by telling the truth. And I just want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I gather he was traveling in Gibraltar when he took ill and was at the cardiac arrest. Is that?
It's very strange. I mean, he's a young man. Who knows what cardiac arrest means? You know, basically, anytime somebody dies, it's cardiac arrest.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure more things will become clear, but at the moment, just kind of feel badly for his colleagues and his family.
Sure.
Appreciate, you know, and I've been bashing the Brits recently, including in the pages of The Atlantic, so I want to throw them a bouquet. You know, when the Brits are good, they're very good. They're not so good, they're not so good.
Right.
But this is one of the good ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll put in the show notes for the audience your Atlantic article on the Brits, since they got a little bit of a taste of it last week in the show. But I, you know, the full Monty probably is worth them actually reading. So
yeah, I was still ticked off. This is about the David Lammy speech announcing that they were, I guess, stopping 30 arms export licenses to Israel. But then he said, well, but it won't really hurt them. But, you know, we're doing it. And it's not that we've discovered war crimes or anything like that. It just, I mean, it was a complete incoherent piece of garbage. What you know, disturbed me more, and I kind of said it rather pointedly about the Brits, also about the Australians, who've gotten off easily, I have to say, let alone the Canadians, is that, you know, the Anglosphere is in one way something very real. I think you and I both feel that and know that and lived it. But on the other hand, when you look at, you know, the military capacity they have, you know, I was actually a bit shocked when I looked at the numbers. you know, the Royal Navy is considerably less than half the size of the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Forces. In terms of men and women under arms, it's smaller than the Italian military, only a bit larger than the Greek military. And then the Australians have also, you know, there's been a lot of attention to AUKUS, but if you look at the number of aircraft they have or the fact that they're shrinking the size of their army, you know, these countries are not acting like we're in the middle of the kind of crisis that we are, in fact, in.
Which is probably a good point at which to turn to one of the subjects you and I really want to discuss this week, which is the intensifying cooperation, you know, that we see among our autocratic authoritarian adversaries, you know, Russia, the PRC, the DPRK, North Korea, and Iran. So just, you know, in the last several days, you've had an announcement of an intensified schedule of joint exercises between the Chinese and the Russians. I think we've mentioned on a previous show the joint bomber flights they took up near Alaska. We also had the news break over the weekend of the shipment of Fata 360 missiles from Iran to Russia. These are missiles that will give Russia a range of something like 700 miles, essentially with which to attack, you know, more of Ukraine's energy infrastructure, basically transformers, energy plants of various kinds, all in an effort essentially to freeze the Ukrainians out this winter. I would note that the G7 in their communique warned Iran against taking this step and saying that this step would be seen as, you know, not just kind of another untoward malign act by Iran, but it would be seen as aggression against Europe. So it'd be interesting to see how the European allies now respond to this.
Yeah, I wish I could say I had my hopes up, but I don't. You know, there's just sort of a parenthetical digression, and then I want to go back to the main topic. There's a British naval historian, Nicholas Lambert, who wrote a very interesting book called Planning Armageddon, which is about the Royal Navy's planning for economic warfare against Germany before World War I.
It's a doorstop, but I've actually read it.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. Not surprised that you've actually read it. I've come across very few things you haven't read. But, you know, one of the things that's so striking about it is, and this is a point that he makes repeatedly in person, maybe we should get him on the pod, that, you know, there's a big distinction between the kind of sanctions that we impose and real economic warfare. And one of the central points he makes is real economic warfare, you know, blows up a good chunk of the international trading system, which is one of the reasons why the Brits don't go all the way. And I think that's part of the problem with the Europeans is, you know, you may get some additional sanctions of some kind, but to really put the screws on, my guess is you'd end up doing things which would cause a lot more of a ruckus and a lot more disruption than people have the stomach for, and what your take would be.
Well, I think that's right. I think the irony here is, or maybe it's a paradox, I'm not sure which, but, you know, as you know well, because we lived through this, our European colleagues actually were much tougher minded in the 2013-2015 period, in which the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Obama administration era, you know, arms control agreement to try and limit the Iranian nuclear program was negotiated. In fact, there was one point at which the French held out for much tougher terms than the U.S. was willing to accept. But it was perfectly predictable that both the French and the Brits, once the agreement was signed, would go back to trying to make money, you know, in their dealings with Iran, and that this would, you know, lead to some unwillingness to actually, you know, hold Iran to the, you know, absolute terms of the agreement. You see that now with the hesitation about snapback sanctions, you know, when the Iranians are clearly violating, and we'll come to that in a minute. But so, yes, I mean, unfortunately, I agree with you. I mean, by the way, Lambert in his book also makes it clear that the Royal Navy way oversold to its, you know, political masters before the war began what they could accomplish.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, starving the Germans out. So I think that's also worth, you know, pausing and thinking about, you know, as well as, you know, when you consider what the options are.
So listen, there are three aspects of this kind of alignment of the bad guys that I wanted to get your views on. First thing is, how close do we think these alignments really are? These are not alliances. It's kind of a loose coalition, I suppose. I mean, we both like to frame these things historically. What would you compare it to? So I think it'd be interesting to try to scope that. I have a very particular question I want to ask you about Iran, but maybe we can get it to the end. I know there's a report that you're very familiar with on the Iranian nuclear program, which just came out of JINSA, which is quite disturbing. But then I think it would also be interesting for us to talk a bit about, well, okay, is there anything we can do about this? I think everybody kind of agreed that you can't really pry apart Russia and China, even though some of the relationship is unnatural. But maybe if we could, I guess, deal with those first two things. So how do we frame this, the set of relationships? And is there anything we can do about it? And then I really would like to draw you out on Iran, which I know you follow more closely than I do.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, I've tried to think of, what the nearest analog is to this. And I'm not sure that there completely is one, honestly. In a sense, I mean, you had during the Cold War, the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship and Agreement. And we had Sergei Radchenko on the show not long ago talking about all the, you know, the testiness that went on and the, you know, the sort of complicated relationship that Mao had to Stalin and then, you know, with Khrushchev. You know, Stalin, he respected as, you know, sort of the legatee of, you know, Lenin, while, Khrushchev, he didn't really have much respect for at all. So there's an element, you know, in this that's like that. But this also involves other countries. So it's not purely like the Sino-Soviet episode. You know, in the run-up to World War II, you had, obviously, the Pact of Steel between Hitler and Mussolini, which ended up being more, you know, of a kind of millstone around Hitler's neck than anything else, right? When the Italians sort of invade, you know, Albania and Greece and get themselves into a mess, is the Germans have to go bail them out. So that, you know, doesn't turn out to be such a great thing. There may be some analogy here to the, you know, partnership without limits that Xi Jinping and Putin announced before Putin started his war in Ukraine. Back in 2022, there was the German-Japanese anti-Comintern pact, you know, and then, of course, in 1940, you have the Tripartite Pact, which actually creates the Axis. But even though that was a alliance, you know, quote unquote, it kind of wasn't really, right? Because the Japanese don't go to war with the Soviet Union when Hitler invades the Soviet Union in June of 1941. So, I mean, I don't know that there's any exact analogy here, but there are things that sort of suggest things. And the things that they suggest are, you need to worry about these things because they lead people probably to take more risk thinking that they've got, these allies with them than they might otherwise. So that's a concern. But they also have inherent built-in tensions, which goes to the point you were making earlier. You know, I think we're now beyond that point. But, you know, the late Zbigniew Brzezinski said that, we should do everything we can to avoid a Chinese-Russian, alliance. Now, I think he overestimated how much agency we have in that, right. Our ability to affect it. But I do think he was onto something in the sense that, I think there might have been things we could have done at the margin to encourage, for instance, the Chinese more in a direction of, say, Belt and Road, because the more they were focused on continental expansion, it would have driven them towards Central Asia, where their interests and Russian interests are, essentially antagonistic, rather than maritime, where, their interests clash with ours. But I fear we've really gotten beyond that point, because now it's taken on an ideological dimension. And both of them share an interest in revising the international order that we largely built. And therefore, I don't know that there's any way out of the conundrum of dealing with this sort of set of relationships. The challenge for us, is that it means that any kind of conflict now, whether it's in Europe or in Indo-Pacific or even in the Middle East, runs a risk of going global very quickly.
Yeah, I think that last point is absolutely critical. And it's one of the points I made in one of the earlier Atlantic pieces about what a President Harris will face. If you were to take that seriously, you'd say, gosh, we really need to spend a lot more in defense than we are, which is, of course, a point that you and your colleagues made in the National Defense Commission. I guess, one thing I found myself thinking about is, to what extent is there an ideological base for what you have here? There is, in one sense, clearly, and that is antipathy to the United States, antipathy to the kind of system that the United States created, a desire to displace it. It's, in that respect, it may be a little bit more like the anti-British coalition during the American Revolution, which people forget. That was a global war, and there were a bunch of countries that came in because they wanted to knock Britain off its perch, and they very nearly succeeded. But I mean, there is a bit more coherence in that there's a profound antipathy to liberal democracy or anything that smells of it, which is a force that is profoundly subversive of each of these regimes. I mean, that I think one of the things that's interesting about this is, in the case of China, this is driven by self-confidence. I think North Korea, there's an element of self-confidence. Russia and Iran, on the other hand, I think it's fear. Although I think in the case of China, there's fear too of, what ideological contamination from the West. So I think that is a peculiar kind of thing. The other thing that I've had, though, which is more troubling, is it seems to me that the longer this goes on, the more they establish institutional kinds of relationships. They get used to exercising together. You have people who know each other's languages. You have people who've used to cooperating on things. I think I mentioned this last week when we were talking about my trip to Svalbard. The Chinese and Russians are up there. Now, they don't have the same interests, to be sure, but they do get used to operating together. And that's not a good thing. I mean, one of the things that's so striking about World War II is there's almost, you mentioned there's no strategic cooperation. There's also virtually no operational cooperation. And such as there was, actually, it ended up hurting the Germans, because the Germans gave the Japanese Enigma machines, which it turns out, of course, we could break. And so we were able to break a lot of the traffic from Japanese ambassador in Berlin to back to Tokyo. He was very well informed, and so he's describing everything he found on a visit to the West Wall just before the Normandy landings. But other than that, and I think they were shipping rubber back and forth, and a few items like that. There was no cooperation. Here, there's much more, and there's a danger of much more as well. So I think it's a profoundly serious problem, which people have not, I can't think of any government figure who's really sort of put this out there squarely, that this is the, you know, fundamental geopolitical fact we've got to deal with, because it's a very disturbing fact, if so.
Well, Bob Gates did do that in a, you know, article he wrote at the end of last year in Foreign Affairs, but he's out of government, of course. So I mean, you're right. I don't think, you know, President Biden kind of came up to tiptoed up to it, I would say, you know, in his Oval Office address after he was in Israel after October 7th, but he didn't quite address it frontally. It kind of, you know, sort of danced around it a little bit. And I think that, you know, one of the real problems here is that the political class, and this is, you know, true of both parties, is just not being straight with the American people about how, you know, dangerous the situation is that we face. I mean, you're talking about operational cooperation. You know, that's one of the reasons I was, you know, took notice of those, you know, joint strategic bombing exercises, because as China becomes a nuclear peer, and we've talked before about this, you know, the fact that the United States now has to deter two nuclear peers, this is like an unprecedented thing. We've never had to do that before. In the Cold War, we had only one real nuclear peer, which was the Soviet Union. I mean, China had a very tiny, you know, arsenal about which we really didn't have to worry. It was really a lesser included case of what we needed to do to deter the Soviet Union. But if you're talking about two arsenals of 1,500 or more, because the Chinese aren't bound by the limits of the New START treaty, you know, that becomes a more challenging thing. And I'm not saying we need to match them weapon for weapon in order to deter them, which is the charge that those of us who are concerned about this are frequently subjected to. But we do have to think about, okay, well, what does it take actually to, you know, to have a secure deterrent, to have a secure second strike capability when you've got two allies who might concert, you know, a nuclear operation against you. You know, people, you know, poo-poo these things until they happen, like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, right? That couldn't possibly happen, you know, because the, you know, Nazis and the Soviets couldn't possibly ever work together, you know, until they did.
Yeah. Do you see fissures in this coalition where we can usefully insert some kind of crowbar?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about some of them in the past. You know, the Chinese clearly are, you know, somewhat uncomfortable. I mean, they're providing a lot of assistance to Russia, but they're not totally comfortable, you know, with what the Russians are doing, and they're particularly not comfortable with the nuclear threats that the, you know, Russians have been making. And they apparently have been, you know, somewhat, you know, vocal about that. I would note with interest, by the way, I'm not sure if you caught it, but the over the weekend, our former colleague in government, Bill Burns, now the director of CIA, was in London for the FT festival, the Financial Times festival, where he and the head of MI5 were, you know,
talking, MI6, I think.
Was it six? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, MI6. We're talking together, doing a kind of panel in which Bill said, you know, he said two things that were interesting. One of which we've talked about on the show multiple times, including with David Sanger and others. One was that he does not believe that, you know, we should be too terribly deterred by Putin's nuclear threats, which I thought was interesting. I mean, Bill is someone who does know Putin well from his time as U.S. ambassador in Moscow. But second, he did confirm that, you know, CIA believed there was this period in the fall of 22 when the Russians were seriously considering the use of nuclear weapons in, you know, or appeared to be considering the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. So I thought that was an interesting moment to note.
Yeah, I have to say on that one, I am just so skeptical that unless I actually saw really good evidence, which in the nature of things, you know, I'm not going to see, I just don't believe it. I mean, I think, and given that we had telegraphed how fearful we were, my initial hypothesis will always be, okay, this is an information op. By the Russians. I mean, I guess one question I have is, speaking of information operations, Do you think that there is something to be done in terms of doing our best to aggravate the kind of, frankly, racial tensions between Russians and Chinese? And that, you know, I mean, the Russians have to be fearful of becoming a vassal state of China. And that's what Putin is turning them into. And it seems to me that's a weakness that we should be very actively playing on. I mean, I find it very frustrating that in all the discussions of, information warfare, it's all about us playing defense and almost nothing about us playing offense.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, you know, a part of the reason for that is something you were sort of saying earlier, you know, which is the very existence of, you know, liberal democracies, you know, is a kind of information operation every day against the Russian and Chinese, you know, Iranian and North Korean systems. And that's how they interpret it. I mean, they interpret our existence as a ongoing challenge to their, you know, ability to control their own populations. And so they've, you know, obviously they're operating overtime. I mean, you just see this constantly now. I mean, it's just like the signs of it are everywhere, right? So you have this indictment about the Russian information op to, you know, create these media entities to recycle all this right-wing stuff. You know, it's pretty clear they want Trump to be elected. You know, there's also the Iranians. I mean, the Iranians clearly have been involved in efforts to stop Trump from being elected. And they have good reasons to expect that, you know, a Harris administration would be, from their point of view, better for them than a Trump administration. So, you know, there's a lot of this activity. And I think, like you, I'd like to be more on offense than just on defense. But I have to say, I'm actually glad that it seems like we're actually doing something on defense, because I think for the longest time, we've actually just let this stuff run free without actually really, cracking down on it. I guess what I would say on the question of wedge driving between Russia and China, I don't think we need to play up too much the racist stereotypes that exist very powerfully on both sides. They'll do that for us. I do think that making the point that, in the case of Russia, that Putin is making Russia a subordinate vassal, as you put it, economic vassal of the PRC. I think that's a very powerful message to get to the Russian population, along with the messages about corruption, which Navalny was so good at exposing domestically. I mean, that I think also really infuriates Russians, and I think we ought to be, you know, trying to push both of those. On the Chinese side, I think it's really more a message of, you know, the Russians are going to get you into trouble, you know, if you just give them carte blanche. Eventually, they're going to drag you into something you don't want to be involved in.
Although I think the difficulty there is going to be, you know, they now have almost 3 years of experience, or the 2.5 years of experience. Russians haven't dragged them into something that they don't want. I mean, they've got problems, but their problems are not of
right.
Russia's
making.
Not really of Russia's making.
I guess what I would say is I think they're very sensitive to, you know, one of the things I think the administration has done well, which is the sort of small yard, high fence sort of technology controls on high-end chips to China. Mm-hmm. And I think their fear of more of that is, you know, sort of that if they continue to support Russia, you know, economically in this war effort, there'll be more of that, that the yard will get bigger and the fence will get higher.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a theme that's worth pursuing with them, because they do seem to be sensitive to that.
What about, and we've been talking about the big partners in this enterprise, Russia and China, and we'll talk a bit about Iran and North Korea, Iran. I mean, do you see anything that we can usefully there to do there to make things harder for them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, again, you know, the sanctions that are actually applied consistently are powerful, right? I mean, the North Koreans, when you and I were in government, desperately wanted to get out of those Banco Delta Asia sanctions, right? Because they wanted to get out of those because they were keeping, you know, Kim Jong-un's father, from being able to, you know, corner the world market on Hennessy, right? So, I mean, you know, that hit the regime where it lived, and that's one reason why they wanted to get out of them. And of course, we foolishly lifted them. But I think you can go after the, you know, the North Korean elite where it really lives by doing that. And with Iran, I would say, you know, actually applying the sanctions, which the Biden administration has not done, you know, I don't say a lot of positive things about the Trump administration. And I think Trump got out of the, you know, the JCPOA in the worst kind of way. I mean, without, you know, a real plan and without real coordination with allies. But I will say that the sanctions, you know, the sort of really tough unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran, which people said can't work because, you know, sanctions have to be multilateral, they really had the Iranians at the beginning of 2021 in terrible economic shape. And unfortunately, because they were pursuing this will-o'-the-wisp of a, you know, renewed JCPOA, the Biden administration really kind of took their foot off the neck of, you know, the Iranian economy.
Well, so I mean, this will be a useful segue into talking about the nuclear program there. It would seem to be, with regard to Iran, I mean, that is a case where we can and should try to do things to actively undermine the regime. That is, to have in mind regime change, not through invasion or anything like that, but through subversion and covert warfare and all the rest. Again, it's a question of playing offense rather than defense. And again, I think that's a strategic choice people have not been willing to make. I mean, if you think about it this way, if somehow that regime was overthrown, it not only would it make the Middle East a much better place, it would actually undermine the Russians in some important ways, and possibly even the Chinese, you know, would not then be looking at a United States would probably be reestablishing its position in the Persian Gulf. So I suppose part of what I'm thinking is, yeah, we are kind of back in a something like the early Cold War, where it looked like there was a Sino-Soviet bloc. You know, we know in retrospect there were a lot of tensions, and in which we did play offense as well as defense, and in these ways, sometimes well, sometimes poorly. And you have to have the mindset that goes with that. And unfortunately, I don't see that. Talk to me about Iranian nukes.
Well, before we do that, let me just make one comment on what you just said, which is, I agree. Our comparative strategic advantage vis-a-vis Iran is that the vast bulk of the Iranian population hates the theocratic regime. And, you know, we have, as you say, we've never really made a firm commitment to actually try and, you know, light that, you know, light the fuse that, you know, lights that fire. I mean, there's also a tradition in Iran of popular uprisings overthrowing the regime. I mean, Ray Takei, as you know, and I wrote actually, about 5 or 6 years ago now, an article in Foreign Affairs advocating precisely this, which what you described as regime change, not by invasion, but by supporting the forces inside Iran that want to liberate the country from, you know, this, you know, mullahocracy that currently rules it. It's not like we haven't been able to do this before. I mean, your colleague at CSIS, Seth Jones, has written a very interesting book about the kind of covert support we provided to Solidarity in Poland, towards the end of the Cold War, that ultimately led to the unraveling, to the liberation of Poland and the unraveling of the Warsaw Pact. So it's not like we, you know, haven't done it before or don't know how to do it. It's just that we have, up till now, I believe, lacked the political will to do it.
I agree. I mean, the Reagan administration, in that respect, I think is an interesting model. But yeah. Still, talk to me about Iranian nuclear weapons.
So I co-chair at JINSA, a task force on Iran with General Chuck Wald, who was the deputy commander at UCOM in the earlier part of this century. And before that was commander of the air. He was CENTAF. He was the Air Force commander in CENTCOM. We recently did a report which was issued today, which I hope will yield a question tomorrow night at the debate if the journalists are smart enough to do it, about a subject that I don't think has gotten nearly enough attention, which is we are sleepwalking our way into a situation that multiple presidents of both parties, going back, you know, to the 1990s, have said they would not allow to happen, which is the emergence of a nuclear-armed Iran. The Iranians have, there are several things that are going on here. One is they are enriching, you know, more and more uranium up to 60%, which brings them closer and closer to the threshold for being able to produce weapons-grade uranium. And essentially making themselves a kind of latent nuclear power without testing a weapon, but certainly having the ability to rapidly make one. You know, North Korea was in that situation for a number of years in the 90s, right? And then ultimately in 2006 tested a weapon. And now, 18 years later, they seem to be on track to building building a nuclear arsenal that will be arguably at least as large as at some point as the British arsenal, or closing in on it, but also having all the appurtenances of a nuclear triad, which is, you know, submarine launch ballistic missiles, you know, ballistic missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and short range missiles with which to attack, you know, the Korean, southern part of the Korean Peninsula and U.S. forces there. So the Iranians are getting close to nuclear latency. They are not cooperating with the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, the executive director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is charged with essentially both monitoring their performance under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, but also the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, to which Iran is a signatory, I might add. They have been uncooperative, particularly in trying to explain how, enriched uranium particles have been found on, you know, various machinery run by the Iranians, and allowing certain facilities that were identified after the Israelis spirited out of Iran, a large archive of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father, if you will, of the Iranian nuclear program, or the director of it, who was assassinated a few years ago. So Grossi is just not getting very much cooperation. And he has drawn attention in his most recent reports to the fact that the regime's rhetoric is changing. You know, for years, the Iranian regime said, oh, we're not building a nuclear weapon. You know, we're just building nuclear capability for commercial use because the Supreme Leader has issued a fatwa that says we can't have a nuclear weapon. Of course, the fatwa can be changed at any time by the Supreme Leader. But now you've got, you know, former heads of the, you know, the Iranian Nuclear Energy Agency, former negotiators, et cetera, saying, well, we have all the parts of a nuclear weapon. We just haven't put it all together yet. And others saying, you know, calling for the fatwa to be reversed and for Iran to move forward with a nuclear weapon. So, you know, I think whoever wins this election in November could easily be confronted early in their term by having to deal with this. And again, this is something that I don't think has been on the front of mind for most American citizens.
So if let me ask the difficult question. If you were, you get called in whichever person wins, and you're convinced that they're actually pretty resolute on this subject at least, and they say, okay, what should I do? What would you say? Would you be willing to advocate a preemptive attack?
What I would say is, in the first instance, I would be in favor of actually implementing the sanctions that are already on the books, which we have not done for 3 years now, particularly the oil sanctions. And I would work with the allies to snap back all the other sanctions before we lose the ability to do that under the terms of the agreement. And, already there have been a number of expiring deadlines. And I would be willing, I would actually be willing to give it one more try to see if you could actually get what the administration said it wanted, which was a longer and stronger agreement, but which it never really pushed very hard for. But I mean, I think it's got to be no nonsense with the Iranians, which is, look, we would rather do this through diplomacy, but make no mistake, if there's not a diplomatic solution, there will be a military solution to this problem.
So in the final analysis, you'd be in favor of a military solution.
If that's what it takes to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, because the consequences of Iran getting a nuclear weapon, and the reason why American presidents of both parties going back 30 years have repeatedly said they're, would take action to stop this, is it'll be the end of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. We will end up having a much more proliferated Middle East and perhaps much more proliferated Indo-Pacific. And that will be a prescription, I think, for nuclear weapons use in the future, not, the lucky status we've had since 1945 of a sort of quote unquote, I hate the term nuclear taboo and I don't use it, but a tradition of non-use of nuclear weapons that's been maintained since 1945.
Yeah, I think, again, this is just something people haven't really wrapped their minds around, that we could be facing a cascade of proliferation. Because if the Iranians have nukes, obviously the Israelis have nukes. I am sure you get Egyptian nuclear weapons, Saudi nuclear weapons, Turkish nuclear weapons. I think if, once that process begins, I can't imagine that the Poles and the Kazakhs and others would be far behind. And then
South Korea, possibly Japan.
If South Korea is going to get nukes.
Taiwan.
But South Koreans are already talking about it.
Right.
And there's even sort of muted talk in Japan about this. So I think, again, we really are on a precipice or coming up to the edge of a precipice. And I just don't, Trump doesn't think about anything really. What I can't tell is whether Vice President Harris, has taken all this on board, or whether her advisors are the kinds of people who take it fully on board. I mean, I think they tend to be more incrementalists, wanting the right things, to be sure, but thinking in terms of one
step. But afraid of the tough measures. There's a wonderful passage, which I know in Churchill's, first volume of his memoir. It's actually in the introduction where he says, this book is going to show you how people with the best of intentions, taking half steps rather than the tough steps that were necessary, led to disaster. And this is, I think, one of those cases where, this is why I say, Jack Kennedy titled his Harvard honors thesis, Why England Slept. This is why I say we're sleepwalking into a Iranian nuclear weapon, because people don't want to face up to the really hard issues and hard choices that are out there, because it's easier to sort of avert your eyes and not actually, have to think about the hard stuff. I guess what I would say is, as I said, I have not 100% given up on diplomacy. We have never actually had a serious diplomatic effort where the other side thought, no shit, if we don't come up with a deal, they're going to, destroy our program, and blow a lot of it up. Now, The challenge is this program is now so big and so ramified, and the argument against a military operation, as you can well imagine, having been in the Situation Room with me multiple times, that people are going to say, well, you know, we can't just do this with one shot. We're going to have to go back and mow the lawn repeatedly, right?
Yes.
And that is what it will take. It will take kind of repeated air campaigns to, you know, knock out the stuff that they're building, because they'll try and go back and build it again.
Yeah.
But I haven't given up on the notion that, you know, you could get a diplomatic solution if you actually were, you know, had some force behind it and were willing to threaten the use of force to, you know, to get an agreement.
Well, I mean, it's something you and I have often talked about. One of the absurdities is when people talk about diplomacy and force as if they're two mutually exclusive things, when actually they depend on one another. You mentioned reading Churchill. I want to get back to that because I think we should talk a little bit about what we're reading. Maybe if we could move us on a bit. Our time is actually a little bit tight, unfortunately. One just kind of quick observation of this week's news. So finally, there's some front page reporting in the Washington Post about what's going on in Sudan, which is appalling. Okay, there's civil war. It's being fed by outside actors, and it just got me thinking that we're now looking at a number of countries where either you have this kind of chaos fed by outside actors, or you have things like Venezuela, where you know a dictator who's a mediocre kind of dictator, Maduro, should have been overthrown, but seemingly can't be. You have Lebanon, which is chaos. You have Somalia, you have Yemen, you have Libya, you have Congo. I do think that these this degree of state, or Somalia, this degree of state failure, somehow you put them, each one is of course their own story. They do tell us something about the decay of the American created international order, and. You know, it's not that it's on us to prevent all these things from happening, but, you know, the international order we created, we had strong allies who would do stuff. But, you know, the French have effectively been chased out of Africa, and they actually played an important role. The British, we were talking about earlier on, don't have the resources or indeed the will, I think, to do the kinds of things that they used to be able to do. And that's a worrisome sign as well. And that is different from where things were in the past, don't you think?
I agree. And the retrograde of American power around the world. I mean, you didn't mention the Sahel. I mean, that's also, sure, you know, an area where, but the, you know, kind of forces you're describing are at work as well. You know, look, these two subjects, the one we just got done with about, you know, the nuclear cascade and which essentially is the result of failure of American extended deterrence, right? We have prevented what Jack Kennedy said he worried about in one of his last press conferences in the spring of 1963, where he said he worried about, you know, 20 nuclear powers at the end of the decade. You know, 40 years on, or 60 years on, there are 9 nuclear powers, and that's largely the result of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and U.S. extended deterrence, which, you know, a number of countries decided to forego developing their own nuclear weapons because they had security assurances backed by the U.S. nuclear arsenal to protect them. And, you know, as people have grown more uncertain about our willingness to defend them, then, of course, they start thinking about Sovkipa and defending themselves. And frequently, if there's a nuclear power in the region, if it's North Korea or Iran, they will look to, or Russia, you know, they will look to either us, or they'll have to do it themselves. And there's you're describing a kind of similar thing, which is, you know, it's a little bit like broken windows theory, you know, in crime prevention, right? If you don't repair the broken window, you know, in a neighborhood one day, you know, next day you get 2 broken windows, and pretty soon you have a pretty rough, lawless neighborhood. And I think what we've seen is that people don't think the United States and its allies, who traditionally were deputy sheriffs in these, you know, some of these parts of the world, to try and hold countries together, however, you know, fragilely. I mean, look, Lebanon's been fragile for a long time, ever since the Syrians went in the 70s, right? But you know, it was held together because there was a sort of loose coalition of countries that would try and prevent it from completely splintering, as it repeatedly threatened to do. And then, you know, same with some of these other places you've mentioned. You know, the danger is when you talk about this, people say, oh, well, you want the United States to be Globocop and go in and fix all these places. I don't think either of us are suggesting that. But what I do think we're suggesting is that, you know, if you don't maintain law and order in your neighborhood, then you get a pretty lawless neighborhood.
There's also, you know, there is a curious thing, and it's I think it's characterized a lot of the discourse around foreign policy, which is, you know, people are afraid of describing a problem as it is, because the implication would seem to be that the United States should send troops somewhere. And so they're not willing to actually confront, look, this is what is going on. You may say it's not worth our doing anything about it, fine. But it is what it is. And people get very reluctant to confront reality because they're afraid that reality might demand of them that they do something.
Well, and of course, you and I have run into this before, and I mean, makes me slightly uncomfortable, because the problem is, you know, if you want to describe something as genocide, genocide has some legal implications because of the genocide treaty and obligations for the U.S. to do something. And so, you know, you and I have been both party to discussions about, is something a genocide and how do we describe it? And, oh, by the way, if we describe it that way, then, you know, what are we obligated to do? So it's, you know, it's a terrible conundrum. You wanted, I know, to talk about the Mark Leibovich article on the collapse of the GOP. I'm wondering whether we might want to hold that off because, you know, as we're speaking today, you know, there's going to be, by the time our listeners get, you know, get a hold of this podcast and get to, you know, write angry notes to us, you know, on YouTube or elsewhere, they, you know, they will have seen the debate that we have not yet seen.
And we'll want to talk about that.
And we're going to want to talk about that. So I think maybe we hold Mark Leibovich and the collapse of the GOP and the heroism of Liz and Richard B. Cheney for what they've done this week to one side. But I know you want to talk about what we've been reading. So what have you been reading?
So two things. I've been on a Russia kick, among other things. So one thing is an article in Liberties, which is a journal edited by Leon Wieseltier, which is it's a very good journal. It's just very thoughtful essays on a range of contemporary things, some cultural, some political. It, you know, reminds me a little bit of the old Encounter magazine back in the 60s and early 70s. There's an essay by Sergei Lebedev, who's a Russian novelist, about Alexei Navalny. And it's a critique of Navalny. So Lebedev is an exile at this point. He's actually written some very interesting fiction. There's one called Oblivion. There's another novel, which is really about dealing with the legacy of the Gulag. And he's critical of Navalny, and I think it's the best critique of Navalny I've had. He said, you know, Navalny, tremendously courageous, no question about that, charismatic, all those things being stipulated. What he went after Putin was corruption. He said, and what he didn't talk about is the Soviet past and the Russian past. And what Lebedev says, until you confront Russia's past, and particularly the Soviet past, you're not going to get anywhere. And he said, in particular, Navalny had this idea that you could have this, you know, bright, new, clean Russia that he would presumably lead, and you don't have to deal with any of that stuff.
Yeah, you don't have to come to terms with the past.
And it's a very well-reasoned and very well-written article, which I commend to people. The journal is called Liberties. So related to that, as I said, I've been on a Russia kick, and I've been reading Letters from Russia by Astolphe de Custine, Marquis de Custine, which I think I first read when I was in graduate school, even. It's a journey in the 1830s by a French conservative aristocrat who expected to go to Russia and kind of like it, and instead comes back appalled. And it's a tremendously powerful depiction of Russian autocracy, and there's foreboding in it, which is in some cases quite chilling. If I could read just one passage to you. Said, if ever they should succeed in creating a real revolution among the Russian people, massacre would be performed with the regularity that marks the evolutions of a regiment. Villages would change into barracks, and organized murder would stalk forth, armed from the cottages, form in line, and advance in order. In short, the Russians would prepare for pillage from Smolensk to Irkutsk as they marched to the parade in Petersburg. So there's a lot of stuff like that, but there's also just one other quote, which I think does kind of speak to where the Russians are today. If there are found among the Russians better diplomatists than among nations the most advanced in civilization, it is because our journals inform them of everything which is done or projected among ourselves, and because instead of prudently disguising our weaknesses, we display them with passion every morning. Whilst on the contrary, the Byzantine policy of the Russians, working in the dark, carefully conceals from us everything that is thought, done, or feared among them. We march exposed on all sides. They advance under cover. The ignorance in which they leave us blinds our view. Our sincerity enlightens theirs. We suffer from all the evils of idle talking. They have all the advantages of secrecy, and herein lies all their skill and ability.
Of course, a lot of those Russian diplomats were Baltic Germans, but never mind.
Yeah, well, that's also true. I guess, you know, the bottom line here is, you know, as a good American, I hate to be an essentialist. That is to say, you know, there's some places which are just rotten. I certainly don't feel that way about Germany, despite its history. I have to say, increasingly, my view of Russia is that the pathologies are so deep, the history of autocracy, of repression, of lawlessness is so, so deep that barring some really cataclysmic upheaval, I find it very hard to imagine a decent kind of Russia. Now, maybe that's, tell me if you think that's too dark. You've lived there and I have not.
I mean, you know, there's an old saying that Russian history is a thousand years of, you know, drunkenness and the knout, you know, the club. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot to that. It's a larger conversation we'll have to have. I'm a slower reader than you are. I mean, I just admire that you're reading other things. I'm just reading things for like future shows that we have booked. Like Lindsay Chervinsky's book on John Adams, which is really great, and the precedents that made the presidency, and our friend Phil O'Brien's book, The Strategists. But I have been reading a few other things, in particular, in light of Tucker Carlson's decision to give some airtime to a guy I've never heard of before, Daryl Cooper, who he claims is the, you know, best and most interesting popular historian, you know, around. He's got a podcast that apparently, since Carlson put him on the show, has gone up to like number one on the podcast chart, but was, you know, making a kind of revisionist argument about Hitler and Churchill in World War II. Churchill's really the villain. Hitler's a poor, misunderstood, you know, average German statesman, as H.A.B. Taylor might have said. This is, first of all, not new, as you know. I mean, this is, you know, Pat Buchanan was writing this, you know, 20, 25 years ago, drawing heavily on the, you know, iconoclastic British historian, John Charnley. So none of this is new. It's not the sort of secret knowledge that only heroic people like Tucker Carlson are willing to, you know, ferret out. But there have been two particularly good takedowns of it that I've enjoyed. One by our Bulwark colleague, Kathy Young, which is terrific. But also, and I don't normally read the Washington Free Beacon anymore. I used to read it. But our friend Andrew Roberts has a really kind of root and branch, you know, destruction of Cooper's argument about Churchill and Hitler. And Andrew, having written a biography of Churchill, as well as two volumes on World War II, including The War in the West and The War in the East, is sort of particularly well situated to, you know, expose all the nonsense therein, you know, contained.
Well, you know, maybe since our time is coming to an end, since this has been one of our darker shows, you know, you mentioned the first volume of the World War II memoirs. And although, look, there's a lot of stuff in the World War II memoirs that is self-serving, or actually more frequently what happened is Churchill smoothed over some of the disagreements with Roosevelt and others. But that first volume, which he wrote well before he really kind of re-engaged in politics in a very large way, thinking of becoming prime minister again, it is a magnificent piece of writing. It is the best volume in those memoirs. And the memoirs are still absolutely worth reading. And it's an inspiring story. And so he is the model for when you're in a dark time and the world is looking dark and your own side is not acting the way it needs to act, a degree of inspiration. And that's, you know, such an important part of his legacy. So, okay, to all our listeners, go out and read the first volume of the World War II memoirs by Winston Churchill.
You know, Churchill famously said, never surrender. I mean, but he meant not only, you know, never surrender physically, but never surrender mentally either. Yeah. to the darkness.
Yeah, never give in.
Yeah. Well, that's an appropriate note on which we can end this otherwise really gloomy episode of Shield of the Republic.